Below them, a faint cheer went up. A small group of what looked like armed farmers and townsmen scrambled onto a speeder that had been backed up to the wall. Then the speeder began to rise straight up. From the mess of timbers overhead, a rope extended. Like a plumb bob on a line, a single, lankily graceful figure in grubby crimson, tattered leather, and what appeared to be pieces of very old stormtrooper armor, rappelled casually down the face. At precisely the right moment, the defender wrapped an extra bite or two of line around one arm, and hefting a beltful of grenades in the other hand, kicked away from the wall in a long, flying parabola, coming pendulum close to the underside of the makeshift assault platform. The men on the platform fired wildly down at the form swinging toward them through the darkness. The timing was flawless. The lone defender hurled the grenades up into the speeder's undercarriage with an expert flick that tangled it with the emergency balance gear. Then the figure struck the wall and kicked off again, swooping on the end of the line back into darkness. The crew bailed out, and the speeder exploded in a rain of red-hot shrapnel. Focusing his mind through the force to pierce the darkness, Luke saw a ragged agglomerate of men and women approaching in speeders. He presumed them to be newcomers. Very few shots were fired once the two sides joined. It seemed more like an enormous brawl, men and women pulling and pushing, hitting with clubs or wrenches or hoes. They were enemies, he thought, but enemies who know they'll be meeting one another in the same food store tomorrow morning. Are those the old-timers, he guessed, and Arvid nodded sourly. Jeez, brained idiots. What business is it of theirs if we bring in ships or not? If we trade our crops for pumps and processors and transport? They can live like animals if they want to, but why make us do it? Disgusted, he shoved over the levers, backed the speeder, and headed down the ridge. Luke thought, maybe because it's their planet? Over his shoulder, he saw forms standing among the struts and timbers of the gun station's superstructure, silhouetted against the glare of the lights. Among them was the thin, graceful form of the Crimson Warrior, and the lean, tiny shape of what looked like a youngish man with long braided hair. Behind them, a thin lance of coal green light stabbed straight upward from the station's main gun, losing itself in the sheer distance of the night overhead. A moment later, another light shot up from far over the hills. Tiny in the distant sky, a bright pin of fire burst. Arvid glanced quickly over his shoulder. Shit, Spawn. Something's coming in. The attackers ceased shoving and cursing. Everyone glared upward. As the gun station's cannon flared again, Arvid braked to a halt. Got one of them. Didn't get them all, though. Gurney will know what stuff came in and what they'll be charging for it. City Ashgad's ship, thought Luke. Beyond a doubt, the attack on the gun station had been coordinated to improve the populist leader's chances of a safe return. Arvid brought the speeder in closer, overtaking the retreating clumps of combatants. Some distance from the gun station, Luke saw a line of immobilized old speeders. The newcomers were clamoring into them. One man called out, "That you, Arvid?" And an elderly woman's voice added, "Where you been, child? And where'd you get that speeder?" "Belongs to Owen here, Aunt Jen," Arvid waved at Luke. "He, took it in trade for an injury." Luke introduced himself, keeping up the story he had told Arvid, that he was a speeder mechanic on his way to Huegshul. "What was that all about?" he asked, referring to the skirmish. A heavyset man with a beard like a banta in malt made an angry gesture. "We just got sick and tired, that's all. We got word a planet hopper was sending in a shipment of chips and droid parts, and them motherless Therans were out to blast them because that brady-haired listener of theirs told them droids were against nature or something." The woman Arvid had pointed out as Yumali Darm moved over to the side of the bearded man's skimmer. She was trim and pretty, with an ion cannon slung casually on her shoulder. "This was serious," she said. "About 6 hours before the attack, there was, I don't know what. I've heard the old-timers talk about force storms, and this must have been one of them. Weirdest thing I've ever seen. Every tool came flying off the bench, whirling around the room like a cyclone, boxes of crystals heaving and jumping off the shelves. They don't think Knapsacker's gonna pull through, he was burned so bad." 6 hours before the attack on the gun station, Luke thought. The very hour he had used the Force to get himself away from his attackers. He had caused the Force storm. Han Solo barely glanced up at Chewbacca. Nothing. He looked at the chronometer. It was a few hours after noon, the bright, misty daylight of the resort moon Hesperidium already losing its strength. There was no possible way he could continue to deceive himself. Leia was late. Very, very late. Chewbacca hauled himself out of the terrace pool and shook, spattering water in all directions. Behind him, among the realistically engineered rocks, Winter glided fish-like with the giggling twins, while Anakin padded solemnly all around the pinkly glowing field of his confinement bubble. The small villa that had housed a succession of the Emperor Palpatine's concubines had been thoroughly swept for listening devices before Leia and her family came for an ostensible vacation on what was arguably the most beautiful moon of the Coruscant system. But Han still felt easier talking on the terrace. Speaking more to himself than to Chewbacca, he muttered, "She should have listened to Callista." In his heart, of course, he knew that Leia couldn't have heeded the warning. The rationalist party had spent too many months setting up the secret meeting with Ashgad and had too much influence both in the New Republic and in the various fragments of the old Empire for the whole matter to be jettisoned at the last minute on the strength of an anonymous note. Leia also had to consider that, though Moff Gatellis of Anti-Meridian was in no position militarily to go against the Republic fleet in the Meridian sector, it was too much to hope that he would not find some way of turning disaffection on that world to his advantage. That was the problem, reflected Han, with power. All Leia could do, when Callista's message had reached her, was include her Nagri bodyguard in the party and run the risk of the hideous scandal that would result if they were discovered. Every precaution that could be taken had already been taken. "She should have run," he said aloud this time. A pleasant voice announced, "Two visitors in the vestibule, Commander Solo. They have declined to present credentials. Would you like them to be admitted, or would you prefer an observation first?"
"Admit 'em."
Han hated spying on his guests. If they came in the door shooting, he and Chewie could probably deal with the situation. Mon Mothma, guiding spirit of the rebellion and former chief executive of the provisional government, held her hands close to the iron fender of the hearth, and the flame outlined her fingers in amber light. Her guard, a gloomy-looking young man whose expression never altered no matter what was done or said around him, sat nearby. Mon Mothma said,
"The entire mission has disappeared."
Something within Han's ribcage went still and cold.
"Disappeared?"
Mon Mothma nodded.
"We're keeping the news quiet for as long as we can. The matter is complicated by the fact that Minister of State Riakan has fallen gravely ill. At first we were afraid it might be related to the plague that has been reported in the Meridian sector, but..."
"Plague?"
Mon Mothma sighed.
"Reports are too fragmentary, to be sure. We can't get med teams in because of the revolt that has broken out on Durin. Local factions have the base under siege. What is more, we haven't heard anything of Leia's flagship or its escort after they reported the meeting acceptably concluded and entered hyperspace at the scheduled jump point. Might someone alter a jump point by remote? Reroute them?"
Han shook his head. "Not possible. Yeah, I'm not a scientist or anything, but those navicomputers are shielded like a Valorzian harem against every kind of solar flare and gamma particle for just that reason."
They sat in silence save for the flickering of the fire. Han said at length,
"I'll get in touch with Lando. We have to keep this small."
Mon Mothma held out a red plast cube.
"These are the final reports from Leia and from her crew, and the sensor readings on Ashgad's ship."
Han escorted her to the vestibule. At the door, Mon Mothma turned to him.
"You be careful."
Han gave her a grin.
"Your Excellency, the day I start being careful is the day I buy myself a foot warmer and a rocking chair. I'll find her." Yamali Darm pecked through a command on the ramshackle keyboard, then turned to Luke.
There. 8.5 months ago, on Buon Neb's run in from Durin. One human passenger, female, 175 centimeters tall. She's the only human female that height all year. Cleared Port Authority under the name Cray Mingla. That's her.
Luke's whole body tingled with grief and joy.
No occupation listed, though in Hweg Shor...
Drat. The screen fuzzed out. The hair at Luke's nape prickled, and turning quickly toward the window, he saw the racing blue tentacles of ground lightning pouring across the gravel, writhing between the pylons on which the newcomer houses were built for just this purpose. Yamali got up and crossed to the open door. Not a big one. It'll pass in about 10 minutes. They stood together in the doorway, watching the electricity race under the pilings of the house.
What are they? Asked Luke.
Yamali shrugged and twisted her white hair up more firmly into its wooden combs.
They seem to start either in the mountains or from those crystal chimney formations. Sills, the old-timers call them, out on the wastelands. I've been caught in them 6 times out prospecting. It's like being knocked down and having your bones polished from the inside, and you're sick for 1.5 days. After that force storm the other day, these don't look so bad.
The walls and furniture of Yamali Darm's little dwelling, like every other building Luke had been in since his arrival in Ruby Gulch last night, bore the marks of the maelstrom of lightning activity that had swept over them at the very hour, Luke guessed the very minute, he had drawn on the power of the force to confuse and distract the Theran raiders. He had done that. The thought made him sick with guilt. Luke was silent, thinking about what he had done.
Do the old-timers ever talk about there being some kind of beings living on this world? Invisible, maybe, or hidden back in the mountains? Something that may be causing this?
Yamali Darm chuckled.
Bless you, Pilgrim, this planet was surveyed 6 ways from next week by the Grismiths before they ever dropped a soul here. I've been darn near all over this rock, never saw and heard a thing. Even the listeners will tell you there's nothing out there.
In the doorway, the tall synth droid bowed to Leia.
Beldorian the Splendid sends his compliments, Your Excellency. He would be honored by your presence at tea.
Will Master Ashcat be present?
Leia exaggerated the haziness of her voice. She had been drinking only a minute amount of the sweet blossom-tainted water, pouring most of the liquid over the side of the terrace in an effort to clear her system of the drug. She had mostly succeeded in combating the sweet blossom's effects, but was left seriously dehydrated in the harsh, dry climate. The fact that no one had come in to make her drink the drugged water had told her that the room wasn't wired.
I do not know, Your Excellency.
Ligeus had told her that she must stand in the sunlight for 15 minutes every day at noon. She suspected it had something to do with combating the effects of the illness. From her post on the terrace, she'd counted at least 5 synth droids. At least 2 bore marks of necrosis, the slow dying of the flesh that covered their metal armatures. Leia changed into her heavy ceremonial robe, and as the synth droid led her to the hut, she took care to note the layout of the house. There were iron blast doors standing open at the bottom of a flight of steps, and through them she glimpsed a vast compound like a docking bay looking out over the plateau edge. A blocky, medium-sized freighter stood there, synth droids moving around it, carrying what looked like the components of a computer core, which meant that construction was fairly far along. As Leia was ushered around a corner and down another flight of steps, the smell of hut rose to meet her. Beldorian shifted his enormous python-like bulk on the dais of air duvets and cushions. Unlike many of his species, he favored gold rings in his folds of fat and on his fingers, and a jeweled stud in his lower lip. On a baldric of gold and reptile leather, he wore his lightsaber.
It is dreadfully slow here, little princess, dreadfully slow. You must find the days weigh heavy in your room.
They do, a little, admitted Leia, wondering what all this was leading up to. Master Ashgard has been very assiduous about seeing to my wants.
Oh, and to mine too, mine too,
Beldorian replied.
Not that I'm in anywhere near the same position as yourself, but, well, I have my comforts, of course, and my chef. Though, quite frankly, little princess, this new fellow's not the cook Zubindi Ebsuk was. Zubindi!
He sighed and groped around in a porcelain washtub of brandy for the spiky balls of marinated prabkros that floated there.
Now, there was a chef. I was desolate when he died. Grant me the right hormones, the right enzymes to inject, he used to say, and I will transform a sand flea into the center course of an imperial feast. And he could, you know.
She felt the touch of his mind on hers.
Ashgard, now. He's made himself the champion of these newcomers. But what is that? When I ruled Wegshul, all the people came to me with their problems. Ashgard couldn't have taken over if I hadn't been tired. All that fighting with that Tasselda woman. Now, taste this, little one.
He extended his hand, and across the room a plate of beaten silver stirred on the sideboard, then floated across to them. It contained roulades of some sort, surrounding a bed of what smelled like petroleum byproducts, topped with a weird blue thing like an enormous berry.
Who was Tasselda? She asked, handing him the plate.
A former colleague.
He plucked the berry from the top of the dish.
She and I came to this world together, many years ago. But she grew jealous of the reverence in which the local population held me, and of my greater skills. She couldn't even manufacture the basic tools of our order. Now, tell me if this is not the most exquisite taste in the galaxy.
Leia cut a section from the berry, and watched as Beldorian slurped down the rest with Rabelaisian enthusiasm before she ate her own fragment. It was delicious. Beldorian's eyes held hers again.
Now a young lady of your talents might find herself needing allies in a situation like this. Ashgard can't be trusted, you know, little one.
A voice said quietly, At least he never sold one of his slaves to Dzim.
Ligeus stood in the doorway.
Beldorian swung around, hissing,
Have a care, philosopher.
The whole length of him twitched, the great 7-foot tail creeping back and forth like a separate angry being as his red eyes narrowed.
Upon another occasion, I told you, I do not brook interference.
Ligeus came forward again and took Leia by the hand.
What did he offer you, my dear? Partnership in ruling this planet? Or just that he'd let you free if you'd put him back in charge?
He raised Leia to her feet and led her to the door. Beldorian made no move to stop them, but as Ligeus reached to touch the opener plate, the hut gestured pettishly in his direction. Ligeus gasped as if struck, half doubled over in agony, his free hand going to his temple. He was ashen with shock and pain as Leia slapped the opener plate and led him through.
Migraine,
Ligeus managed through lips drained of color.
He does that sometimes. Sometimes worse.
As they made their way to the stairs, Ligeus urged,
Don't trust him, my dear. He couldn't protect you from Dzim, and he could not defeat Ashgard. Even years ago, when Ashgard first reached this planet, Beldorian was no match for him.
Leia looked up, startled.
But the original Ashgard...
Ligeus looked away, and she could see that he'd said more than he meant. He ushered her gently into her room and, stepping quickly out, closed the door between them. The only conclusion she could draw was that the man who claimed to be the son of Seti Ashgard was himself Emperor Palpatine's old rival for senatorial power. Was, in fact, Seti Ashgard himself. The house Luke sought lay deep in the heart of the old-timer quarter. Broken pipes crossed the dirty white stucco of the walls. A few desiccated stumps clung to niches overgrown with snig vine, like almost everything else in the grubby old-timer quarter. The door opened before he knocked on it.
The woman standing on the low slab of crystal was of indeterminate age. Luke knew she wasn't young, in spite of the porcelain perfection of her face. Her hair was raven black and hadn't been washed in weeks. Neither had her trim, high-breasted, long-legged body, or the dingy green dress that wrapped it. "Welcome." She drew him into the dense shadows within the first of the house's many rooms.
"I am Tethelda of the Knights."
Her eyes met his, jeweled blue under flawless brows.
"But then, you knew that."
Luke looked around. Most of the transparasteel had been boarded shut, and the room was illuminated only by a string of old-fashioned glow bulbs tacked to the ceiling. His heart went out to her in compassion. She had been here for who knew how long, unable to use her powers for fear of harming the innocent in a force storm. "I'm called Owen," he said. "And I'm looking for someone."
"Ah."
The blue eyes smiled. She crossed to a cupboard and took out a pair of goblets, old Corellian glasswork, tulip-shaped and very valuable. She flicked a drop off the base of one. Luke saw that the cupboard skittered with them. She poured wine.
"Callista. You've seen her?"
His whole being was a shout of triumph.
"How not? I am her teacher now, in the ways of the Force."
The wine was from Durin, and not very good, but Luke sipped it, his eyes on the woman before him.
"Where is she? Can you take me to her?" "Of course. I have been waiting for you since she spoke your name."
Tethelda took both of his hands in hers.
"There's a cave in the hills, not far from here. The Force is strong there. It's one of the places where the ground lightning emerges. I sent her there to meditate. I'll take you. Have you a speeder?"
He nodded. "I have to get it fixed, but I can do that in a day or so."
"And weapons?"
He touched the blaster and the lightsaber at his belt. Tesselda's face fell.
"It isn't enough. We will have to wait."
Luke felt a twang of panic. "Wait? What's the problem?" Tethelda shook her head with the air of one not wishing to burden a friend with her troubles.
"It's nothing."
"Can I help?"
"I couldn't ask you to. It's my affair alone."
"Tell me, please." Her smile was shy and a little self-deprecating.
"It's been a long time since I had a champion. Your Callista is lucky, Owen." "It's an old story, my friend. When first I came to this world, I only intended to accomplish the minor mission the Masters of the Jedi had ordered for me, and to depart. But seeing the way the people lived, squabbling endlessly over pump rights and who was entitled to grow which crops on which piece of land, I could not leave. I lent such talents as I possessed to the side of the people. With my lightsaber in hand, I led them to a stronger and more peaceful way of life. After the fighting was over, these people made me their ruler, and I was happy."
Luke nodded, seeing in his mind this beautiful woman in her warrior youth. She went on,
"But many years later, another Jedi came to this world, an evil creature. Beldorian, he was called. He was not strong in the Force. He worked through violence, lies, and calumny, until everything I had done here was given a sinister significance. My friends turned against me. Beldorian was too feeble an adept to manufacture his own lightsaber, so he stole mine. Well, it was inevitable that he should succumb to his vices. He was ousted many years ago by Seti Ashgard. Ashgard took from him his very house and all the treasure inside it, treasure which he had stolen from me."
Her voice became somber.
"And most importantly, somewhere in that house is my lightsaber."
Luke said softly,
"Ah."
She looked at him sadly.
"We will be vulnerable when we go to the cave to find your Callista. Ashgard's servants are merciless. The more so because they are no longer human, but only human-seeming droids."
Luke grinned at her. He felt light and buoyant, as if his bloodstream were filled with fire. "I'll get your lightsaber for you. We'll be out of town by nightfall." Tethelda smiled softly at him.
"She told me I could trust you, Owen. I saw the light in her eyes when she spoke your name. Callista."
Luke's whole body seemed to be singing as he strode down the ill-paved back streets of the old-timers' town.
"I found her. I found her."
His steps slowed. When she spoke your name, Tasselda had said. But Callista would not have known that he would be calling himself Owen Lars. He stopped and realized he had missed his way among the near-identical white houses, and he thought there was something in the wine. Tasselda was using him. He turned his steps back towards her house and saw her through the back door across the grubby yard. She was groping for something behind furniture and under cushions. She faced him, her blue eyes wide and furious, and he felt her mind pull on his, felt the weak, diffused shoving of the force. Then she began pulling drocks off her arm and eating them with her broken teeth. Luke turned away. It was less the force than his years with the rebellion that made him pick up almost instinctively the sense of danger. And only in the next second, the sound of running feet. He ducked as a spear buried itself in the dirt just beyond where he'd stood. Someone hurled a rock, and he sprang back as an old-fashioned sodium blaster bolt ripped a charred line in the wall at his side. Luke could have scattered them with a blast of the force, but he dared not. A girl of no more than 16 ran at him with a club, and he swept it aside with his forearm and fled down an alley. The little gaggle of old-timers ran after him, cursing and shaking their weapons.
"Here now, what's all this?"
bellowed a voice. The old-timers skidded to a halt. An 8-foot Arthurian in the blue uniform of the Hwaegsoul Municipal Police came walking down the alley.
"Shame on the lot of you,"
warbled the hammerhead.
"What do you think you are? Nothing?"
There was a muttering among the old-timers. Someone dropped a rock she'd had in her hand. Someone else said something about the evil one.
"Yeah, well, mobbing a man who didn't even fire a blaster he's carrying doesn't sound like evil to me, sugar. Get out of here, the bunch of you, before I run you all in for disturbing the peace."
The Arthurian officer turned to Luke as the crowd dispersed.
"You okay?"
"I'm fine. Crazy Therons."
"Not Therons. These are the ones who attacked Master Ashgard's house. I suspect they're the ones who killed the last of his human servants early this year, though I can prove nothing. I know it was they who kidnapped that young woman."
Luke felt as if he'd been kicked in the chest. "Young woman?" The Ithorian regarded him for a moment, speculation in its golden eyes.
"She called herself Cray, but forgot on a number of occasions to answer when spoken to by that name. She was dragged away one night, but before I could find where they took her, I encountered her in the street. She said they were her friends."
Luke spoke through dry lips. "Have you seen her?"
"She left Hwaegsoul within a week of her arrival, of her own will, so far as we know."
Han Solo swung down the ladder from the observation port and crossed to Lando Calrissian Station at the long-range scanners. "Okay, what do we got?" Lando flicked a calibration switch on the console of the Millennium Falcon and studied the image of the wreck far below.
"It's big enough to be the Adamantine. By the heat streak in the atmosphere, they've been down there for about 10 hours.
Planetfall was a nightmare. The atmosphere was a whirling rack of storms, and the Falcon was buffeted like a plastine plate in a riptide. Han and Chewbacca worked side by side over the console as the sensors began to pick out the debris on the ice below. The serial numbers showed that the ship, wedged into a chasm and locked in ice, was the Corbantes. Not the Adamantine, not the Borealis, not Leia. Han didn't know whether to feel relief or despair. Leaving Lando at the Falcon's controls, Han and Chewie suited up and went out. Hanging on for dear life against the butcher winds that obscured the faceplates of their E-suits with flying ice and let themselves down the frozen cliff toward the wreck. Han yelled into the helmet mic, "Small craft!" He pointed at the burn marks that scored the hull. "That's darn heavy guns for a planet hopper, even if you could get one out this far." The crew they found in the outer holds were dead, lying under white mounds of frost and ice. Radiation warning lights were on all over the ship. Further inward, they found those who had survived, barely, by crouching near the fading heat of the reactors in a bid to outlast the cold until rescue could arrive. 17 of them were still alive among twisted heaps of the dead. 2 more died while Han and Chewie went through the agonizing process of loading them onto antigrav tables and struggling up the cliffside to the Falcon. They rigged life support equipment in holds originally stocked with the smuggled glitter stim and rock ivory that had been Han's stock in trade years ago. Lando guided the bucking, heeling freighter up through the insanity of the atmosphere again.
Where do we take them?
Bag shows, probably our best bet. The medical facility's there and a small base. At least we can check out enemy movements in this sector. I didn't see signs of heavy artillery, but it takes more than just a couple of planet hoppers to put out a cruiser.
Something hit the Falcon like the zap of a live wire. Han gave a yelp of protest and dove for the control panel even as the impact hurled him off his feet.
Where are they coming from?
There's nothing out there,
screamed Lando. Another laser beam caught the shields and overload lights went on over the main console. There was nothing on the targeting screen. Han was already scrambling up the ladder to the gunnery turret. Lando's voice yelled in his earjack.
You see them?
Han saw. They were like microscopic dust on the monitor. Each was about the bulk of a laser cannon, barely large enough to accommodate a pilot.
The stars veered wildly as Lando evaded. Against the black of space, Han saw only a quick gleam through the turret ports. Whatever they were painted matte black and bore no lights at all.
Blast it! They're everywhere!
Han got off a scattering of shots, but it was like trying to hit gnats with a smash ball club. Another hit, and the thin patch in the shield registered as a hole. Lando flipped and swerved to cover the open shield. Han hoped those guys in the hole were strapped in tight.
Drones! He shouted.
You can't send a drone through hyperspace, and that's no drone shooting.
A blast of white at the corner of Han's eye told him the miniature ships had taken out part of the Falcon's upper structures.
Were they ships at all, thought Han? What did they have in there, little guys the size of his thumb?
I'm going to clear us a path. Straight through 7x6, bearing 0. Punch it on 3.
Han, old buddy, what...
Do it!
At the same moment, Han hit every 4 cannon he had. Columns of white destruction flowing out in an almost continuous burst. Like a piton chasing its shadow, the Falcon followed the white path of light, as Han calculated by feel rather than instrumentation when the last possible moment would be to jump without hurling themselves into their own fire. The little toothpick ships came pouring back in the wake of the blast, firing at the now steady target following the light. Han counted. 1, 2, this had better work. The last of the shields went in a flare of white. 3! Lando hit it, and the stars stretched into lines of white.
You find your friend? Luke raised his head from the valves he was cleaning and grinned at Yamali Darm. He wasn't surprised to see her. Arvid had told Luke when he'd recommended him for the job as mechanic at Kroig's Fix-It Barn that it was the biggest repair shop in Hueg Chul, which meant on the planet. What can I do for you?
I wanted to ask your boss if I could bring in the skid after I unload it. We're sending a shipment up tonight, or trying to. Lorinar's got a pickup cruiser in high orbit.
Lorinar? Luke was suddenly curious. You sell the crystals to Lorinar Corporation?
The way Arvid had spoken, he'd gotten the impression that Darm's was a small-time operation, digging in the desert for crystals to make some kind of obscure optical equipment useful only to university research labs. Lorinar was anything but small-time. Darm dug in the pocket of her vest and fished out a hunk of crystal.
Smokies, we call them, or spooks. See what happens when I hold it up to the light?
Luke looked.
See those gray lines in it? Now watch.
She carried it to where the recharger crouched like a greasy metal monster in the corner. Gingerly, she pulled out a recharger block, set the terminals against the crystal, and thumbed the switch. Luke flinched as the disturbance in the force axed his brain.
Darm didn't appear to feel anything. When he recovered, he took the crystal from Darm's hand and held it to the window again.
The thread-like gray striations had changed their orientation, forming two star-like blotches where the terminals had touched. The prospector grinned. They can program them. Realign the structure to act as a receiver. She glanced at him more closely. Are you okay, Owen?
Yeah.
Luke rubbed his temples, trying to gather his wits.
Yeah, I'm fine.
No wonder the planet reverberated with the force, he thought. Could these crystals be used to... Jarm went on. There's a meeting tonight. Seti Ashgad's back. Turns out he met with some bigwig in the Republic. We're all going to his place, that big old joint that used to belong to some hut way long ago. If your friend's still in settled territory at all, someone will have seen her. Ashgad's palace, though typical of hut dwellings in its burrow-like arrangement of rooms leading out of rooms, round doors, and feeding niches in every available wall, had been in human ownership long enough to have had windows put in, and it had been cleansed many times. Synth droids guarded the door to the palace. He doubted that most of the people in the room realized that the guards weren't human. When Luke entered the house with Arvid and Aunt Jin, he reached out with his mind, calling Callista's name, searching for some trace of her. But whether because of her loss of ability to use the Force, or because of the strange, thick presence of the Force in the ether of the planet, or simply because she was not and had never been here, he felt nothing. Gurney Caslow jostled over to them through the crowd.
Arvid, we're looking for a couple of boys for a job. There's a drop coming in tomorrow night.
Arvid leaned forward. Where?
10 Cousins.
Luke had heard Kroeg speak of the place. The cousins were sills. Crystal chimneys standing in a ring, markers of some unknown geological process.
Caslow studied Luke. We can use as many as possible. I hear it's a good-sized cargo.
The lights dimmed. A curtain at the back of the room parted, and Seti Ashgad stepped through. As he began to speak, Luke thought how the sun had the same easygoing charm and quick promises that he had witnessed in hollows of Ashgad's father, who must be in his 80s now.
Now, we can't have any of that, Ashgad was saying to a raucous suggestion that Republic troops would soon be on hand to settle for the Terrans. They're the majority, after all. It's their planet.
Gurney Caslow sprang to his feet.
It's our planet, too. We bust our backs putting plants on this motherless rock. Don't that count?
I thought so.
Ashgad swept the crowd with a green eye, suddenly cold and angry.
I was optimistic enough to assure you I could do something about that. It appears I was wrong.
Silence fell, but Luke felt anger pass like ground lightning through the crowd. Ashgad went on.
Perhaps I should let Her Excellency, Leia Organa Solo, tell you in her own words the result of our meeting.
The light in the chamber dimmed further, and a hollow of Leia appeared. It was of crystal clear quality. The heavy folds of her robe of state spread around her. Nearby, Nogri bodyguards squatted on their hunkers, nearly a dozen strong. Leia's chin was up, and she spoke with a cold precision.
I'm afraid that any help from the Republic is out of the question, Master Ashgad. Too many people see the efforts of the rationalists on your planet as disruptive, unruly, and criminal.
A buzz stirred the crowd. Beside Luke, Gurney Caslow muttered,
I'll show you, criminal, honey.
Leia's image went on.
And quite frankly, the discontent of a handful of settlers on a world that isn't even a member of the Republic is not worth the 2 billion credits it would cost. Not to mention the damage done to the Republic's image, should we intervene in your quarrel.
The crowd cried out angrily. Luke seethed, knowing that to protest that the Hollow was a fake would only reveal his own identity. For one thing, Leia never appeared in public with the Nagri. For another, Luke saw when she rose that the chair she had been sitting on was nothing like those in the Borealis conference room. A good slicer could get a hollow of Leia's face and alter the movements of the lips to mesh with any voter-modified script. But the people in the room believed what they saw, and they were furious.
Under pouring rain, the port of Bagsha on the planet Nimdrovus crawled with troops. Han had alerted the med center that he had 15 critical cases on board. Izum Ulos, the Hodin physician he'd talked to, awaited him in the docking bay with an emergency team. Surrounded by a squad of uniformed Drovians, who seized Han's arms the minute he came down the Falcon's ramp, shoved him up against the wall, and searched him none too gently.
"Is this really necessary?"
demanded Dr. Ulos indignantly. Han also expressed himself to the head of the Drovian squad, one Sergeant Nizik Sralpixor, along the same lines, but with considerably greater emphasis.
"Doc, if you'd seen some of the armaments coming in for the Gopswall tribes, you wouldn't be asking that."
Dr. Ulos ducked his tentacled head as he accompanied Han, the sergeant, two troopers, and the med team back up the ramp.
"You must excuse us. The Gopsuo have been restless for months, ancestral enemies of the Drovians."
The Drovian sergeant grabbed Han's arm.
"Those Malt spawn killed my family, see?"
The Hodin informed Han gently.
"It's necessary that they be permitted to search the ship. With local unrest as violent as it has been, and with 40 deaths from the plague so far on the Republic base..."
Aghast, Han stared up at the willowy form towering over him.
40?
"I fear so. It's why I questioned you so closely before I was permitted to give you medical clearance. That, combined with Gopsuo raids on the suburbs, has made the atmosphere here terrible."
Han followed the physician into the next hold. "What's going on? People down with the plague here? We get attacked by something I've never seen anywhere? A partisan revolt on Durin?" He gestured at the forms of the Corbantis crew. "And somebody sure shot down these poor guys." Dr. Ulos and his team passed swiftly from victim to victim, injecting anti-shock and stabilizers, transferring them to stasis boxes on antigrav tables. Through the open boarding ramp, the sound of shots could be clearly heard. Han ducked back onto the bridge and motioned to Lando. "I'm going to find out..." Shots could be clearly heard. Han ducked back onto the bridge and motioned to Lando. "I'm going to find out what's going on out there. Don't take the engines all the way down. If I haven't linked with you by then, take off and find Leia. Whatever it costs." After Her Excellency had been kidnapped, R2 and 3PO's distress signals had been answered by a smuggler who had taken them as far as Bagsho. Now he and R2 were in a tap calf entertaining customers in hopes of earning passage to the fleet orbital base at Psi-Block 12 on Durin to share the awful news of the princess's abduction with the proper Republic authorities. Given the capabilities of a high-quality protocol droid to reproduce languages, complete with inflections and tonalities, C-3PO could duplicate nearly any of the 30,000 songs popular in the core worlds over the past 75 standard years. One patron, a Chadra fan, piped up,
"Can you play Mundergreen's Fugue in K?"
naming a classical piece of great grandeur. It was one of 3PO's favorites. But the swelling strains of the fugue had the effect of emptying the bar of all customers still clear-headed enough to walk.